The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ+ community and beyond, including, but not limited to mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, I'm Syeda Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
Today on Rainbow Country, Liza, a truly terrific, absolutely true story. That and more next. So stay tuned for Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Harder, porn star, burlesque performer, and the creator of Porn to Be a Star. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
And welcome to Rainbow Country, as I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. As always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. Well, thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into an award-winning, nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being a number one LGBT podcast. So today, my 2024 interview spotlighting the documentary Liza, a truly terrific, absolutely true story. A documentary on the legend herself, Liza Minnelli. And joining me is the film's writer and director, Bruce David Klein. We'll get a glimpse behind the scenes of this Oscar-winning icon and so much more. Plus in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that and more lie ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. Our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, award-winning creator Tilly Bridges reads from her book, Begin Transmission, The Trans Allegories of the Matrix, tracking one person's transition journey from Thomas Anderson to Neo to Trinity.
The Matrix is a confirmed and intentional trans allegory, written and directed by two transgender sisters, Lily and Lana Wachowski. They weren't out as trans when the first three movies or the Animatrix were made, but publicly came out as trans before the fourth movie. This changes the context for some of the films, which we'll discuss along the way. I want to remind you that these movies are fantastic humans versus machines sci-fi movies, and that the first absolutely revolutionized action movies and special effects, and there's also entire religious and philosophical metaphors to explore. All of those things are well worth discussing. The movies are so dense and have so many layers, I'm in awe as a writer. But I'm only going to talk about the trans allegories. Please don't take that as an indication I don't think those other things exist or aren't worth discussing. It's just that these allegories are so densely packed with detail about the trans experience that it's going to take this entire book to explain them. Note that the very name, Matrix, means a set of rules and procedures that define how something works. The society we all live in is our matrix, and yes, it does have you, well, many of you. It's the cisgender binary we're all forced into at birth without our consent. It restricts us and harms us in all sorts of ways, which these movies will show you time and again. Neo's our lead, and The Matrix is about his journey in coming to terms with the fact that he's transgender. Reloaded is about all the ways society comes for you once you're out as trans and wondering if we would have transitioned if we knew how hard life would become. Revolutions is about dealing with our own internalized transphobia and where we might be able to go in the future, or where we hope society might go. Resurrections is about detransitioning and retransitioning and the co-opting and erasure of trans voices, but we have to go in order for everything to make sense. Neo always presents as male in the movies, of course, but remember this is allegory, and the first movie was also made in 1999. Here we are over 20 years later, and we still don't have a transgender sci-fi action movie lead. We can't hold that against them. The surface-level story is about Neo accepting that he's the one, and there will be much more on that later, but his journey is a trans one. His chosen name, Neo, literally means new. His dead name is Thomas Anderson. Thomas means twin, and Anderson means son of Andrew, and Andrew means manly or masculine. This means his name roughly translates to twin of the manly or masculine. This is your very first indicator of just how intentional these allegories are. You don't accidentally pick a name that means twin of the masculine for a trans allegory. And even if you somehow did, if that was the only evidence, then sure, maybe it's a coincidence, but it's only the tip of the tip of the tip of the iceberg. Morpheus, in mythology, is the god of dreams. In The Matrix, Morpheus is Neo's superego and subconscious, and knows of his dream to be his true self. He knows the truth about Neo and spends every movie trying to help him accept it. Cypher is Neo's id and his doubt. A cipher is literally a secret, a code that hides the truth. It plagues Neo, eating at him. His id is so sure that he's in fact not trans and would be all too happy to just never think about it again. Neo's doubt is later personified by Link and then Bugs, but those are very different kinds of doubt that we'll discuss when those characters appear. Trinity is Neo's self-actualization, the person he wishes to be. Her name alone tells you she's Neo. 1. The ego. Morpheus. 2. The superego. And Cypher. 3. The id. All rolled into one. Trinity's in balance, in harmony, a whole person. Also note, she is a woman. The other three are men. Neo has to reconcile these supposedly male aspects of himself if he ever wants to attain self-actualization. Note how similar Neo and Trinity look, even down to their hair. None of that's by accident. Everything in a movie is a choice. And not only does this also hold through all four movies, I submit to you it is the entire point of all four movies. They tell the journey of one person from Thomas Anderson to Trinity. Agent Smith begins as the personification of society and the passive transphobia it exhibits by designing a system, the cisgender binary, that does not even account for the existence of transgender people. Over the course of the first movie and then through the sequels, he comes to represent active transphobia, the parts of society that acknowledge trans existence, only so they can then attack it and try to make it impossible for us to exist within it. Other important things to know before we start. The Oracle is Neo's heart, later replaced by Bugs. Tank is the trans community, later replaced by Zion and then Io. Locke is Neo's fear. Niobe is Neo's confidence, and the color red is vital to understanding all four movies, wherein it stands for unequivocal truth. Know that it stands for truth now, and the explanation for why that is will come early in discussing the first movie. Blue stands for doubt, and yellow for fear. Always. The mixture of these colors is also used to convey more complex things. Purple shows you there's truth and doubt. Orange shows you there's truth and fear. The green overcast of the original trilogy shows you the world the cisgender binary matrix has created is based in fear and doubt. Yellow plus blue equals green. All agents, police, and security guards across all movies are cis white men. This is also intentional. It's showing you who benefits from the false cisgender binary, who set it up, and who extracts power from it to keep themselves at the top. This is also why the architect and the analyst are cis white men. These are the bedrock of the allegories. The foundation of everything else is built on and used to say all that the Wachowskis have to say. The good news is these are explained to you through the movies themselves. We're going to go through them all in order, not exactly frame by frame, but it might as well be for as much as these movies have to say. To truly understand the allegories, you'll need to go in order and read them in the order written, in the order of the movie's release. Jumping ahead will only lead to confusion, so I don't recommend it. But technically, you can if you want to. I mean, I'm not the boss of you. I can only show you the door. You're the one that has to walk through it.
In the 60s, before the internet, to find each other, queer people needed to actually get together in real space and real time. Since most places didn't tolerate our kind, depending on where you were, your options could be limited. Large cities might have a few specialized commercial spaces, but in the absence of those, it was basically public washrooms, parks, or house parties. They all had their downsides. Commercial spaces required you to spend money, and that's one of the reasons why they were mostly for men. Even in places as big as Toronto, there was seldom more than one lesbian bar at a time. Lesbians earned about 60% of the male wage and probably had more dependents. The economy just wasn't there. The old adage was, gay men go to restaurants, lesbians hold potlucks. Washrooms and parks were also pretty much boys only and could be dangerous. Plus, parks in the Canadian winter, not so good. You could freeze your willy off. House parties, you needed to know somebody, or know somebody who knew somebody, and so on, and be invited. In terms of commercial life, Montreal had led the pack, developing a sin city reputation during Prohibition in the U.S. in the 1930s. And where there's sin, there's always a place for us. Toronto the Good and Vancouver took a bit longer, but in 1974, Toronto had enough anonymity and a critical mass to produce a small commercial scene. At first, it was mostly straight bars where we were tolerated in a corner as long as we behaved. Next came a few straight-owned venues that served gay clientele. By the mid-70s, a new class of gay entrepreneurs emerged and started to open up on Church Street where rents were cheaper. But not everybody lived in Toronto or Montreal. In smaller centers, where businesses couldn't meet community needs, the lesbian and gay liberation movement of the 70s came up with a new model. Defy economics and do it for ourselves. We might not have a lot of capital, but we did have free labor. For example, the Lesbian Organization of Toronto established a non-profit community center in a ramshackle old Victorian house in 1977. It held dances and brunches and drop-ins and provided meeting spaces and a coffee house and hosted a phone line for a whole generation of women. Loot, as it was known, was following a strategy already developed elsewhere. In Saskatoon, the Zodiac Friendship Society opened its community center in 1973. Edmonton and Calgary soon followed suit. HALO, the Homophile Association of London, Ontario, started in 1974, and the Halifax Gay Alliance for Equality first began running dances in the Turret in 76 and later turned that into a community center. By the end of the decade, there was a network of lesbian and gay groups providing community spaces in dozens of medium-sized centers across Canada, volunteer-run and community-controlled. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
Up next, Liza, a truly terrific, absolutely true story.
Hi, this is Amanda Marshall, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Gather around, I got a story to tell.
Tony's, a Grammy, an Emmy, even an Oscar, she has done it all.
She has achieved that rare status where only a first name is necessary.
The one and only Liza.
I didn't see you now, didn't you?
Born to Hollywood royalty.
Vincente Minnelli.
Superstar Judy Garland.
I thought, Mama, she's never going to pass.
Her fight was to find who she was. She didn't want to be a mother.
Her mother's passing was a catalyst.
A period of incubation.
She found friends and mentors who helped her.
He gave her an entire sense of self.
There was so much expected of her.
She had the thing that you can't teach.
She blossomed.
Everybody wanted to be with Liza. Everybody wanted her at their parties.
She's hot, she's sexy, she's weird, and she had that fierceness and so much vulnerability.
How are you doing?
Terrific. Fine. I feel wonderful about love.
Excuse me.
Because I wanted it to be like it was in the songs.
That last husband of hers, I was at the wedding. Oh, my God.
Legendary actress and singer Liza Minnelli has checked into rehab.
I was very worried.
How lucky I was to have gone through all of the bad stuff that I've gone through, because it prepared me for the rest of my life.
If the public sees Liza as a barrel of sequins and glamour, they've got her wrong.
She wanted to consume the fullness of life. I don't think she has any regrets.
Don't draw bones.
David Klein, hello, how are you?
I'm great. I'm feeling very Liza this week.
Are you? Because you are coming from a sleazy hotel room somewhere in what, Palm Beach?
We're in Palm Beach for a special event screening tonight. And then we open in New York tomorrow and in LA the following week. So this has been a whirlwind of Liza.
Well, I have to say, Bruce David Klein, thank you for being here, especially to talk about your documentary, Liza, a truly terrific, absolutely true story. This is your documentary about Liza Minnelli, the one and only, the great living legend, Liza Minnelli. Let's just jump right in. You write, you produce, you direct this film. Let's go back to the very beginning, the heart. The spark that started this all off. Where does this come from? What's the genesis? What's the spark? What's the flashpoint that made you say, it's time for me to make this documentary on the legendary Liza Minnelli? What's the origins?
Sure. Looking back on it, it was actually pretty long in coming and pretty obvious that it was going to kind of come to this at some point. My first recollection of Liza was when I was too young to see Cabaret, but young enough to see the poster and say, my God, that is really naughty, and I really want to see that. So that was kind of the first instance. And then in 1980, I was old enough to see movies, and I saw Arthur. And I remember saying, oh, my God, this Liza Minnelli is such an incredible comedic talent. You know, who is she? Oh, my God. She was the one on the Cabaret poster. And so I started doing a deep dive into her at that time, you know, watching Cabaret and Sterile Cuckoo and her movies before that. But what really happened to me, and it was actually a very moving moment in my life, very memorable, was in 2008, I went and saw Liza's at the Palace on Broadway. And at that time, there was a very, very big question as to whether or not Liza could still sing. She had gone through some health issues. She had gotten through the wild marriage. And there was a big question. And people were like, can she still sing? Can she still dance? And, you know, can she still act? Can she still perform? And I will never forget it. I mean, this was just a seminal moment in my kind of love of culture moment where, there were hushed. Everybody was hushed in the audience. What would she look like? What would she do? And she came out and the spotlight just shot on her. And she immediately did one of these kind of Liza. I'm not going to, do Liza now, but a Liza hand hip kind of signature move. And the audience lost its mind in a way I've never seen before or after. I've seen all the greats perform, Frank Sinatra, David Bowie, Rolling Stones, everybody. I have never seen anything like this where people were, as I say, not just giving her a standing ovation, but standing on the Broadway seats and grown men and women with tears streaking down their cheeks. I mean, I had never seen anything like that. And I remembered at that moment, my God, this woman has a hold on people that goes way beyond. I like her music, way beyond. I like, her movie, or I like her as an actress. I like her as a performer. This was something very profound and a very, very deep connection. So when we started talking to the Liza people at the behest of someone in our office, our co-producer, Dana Craig, who worked with Alex Goldstein, our producer, and Dana said, oh my God, we have to put Liza on our list of prospective subjects. And when we started calling the Liza people, we were, at the beginning feeling each other out. What are your credits? What have you done? Liza does very few things, blah, blah, blah. And then they said the most incredible words you can to a documentarian, which is, by the way, Liza just found 25 hours of never before seen footage from the 1970s. Are you interested in seeing it? And I will never forget it. We got some selects in, we brought it in. We all kind of sat around and watched it. And I like to say there were people multi-generational, because everybody has a different memory or connection with Liza. I always say that some people think she's a great sitcom star because of Arrested Development. Some people know her as, oh, she did the cameo in Sex and the City. So when we hit play and we started watching the footage, it was so incredibly moving to see this explosive talent at her height. She was the Taylor Swift. She was the it girl of that era. And, in the decades since, there were a lot of other things we think of Liza for. She had toured with Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. She had had some challenges with marriages and substance abuse. So to see her at her height, we said, this has to be the core of a film. So we went back to them and kind of pitched this idea of using the 70s as this kind of era of, when Liza became Liza, which was actually the original title of the film. And they kind of connected at that moment and said, okay, we entrust this material and Liza's story to these people. So that's kind of the long-winded answer as to, but the truth of how everything came back, I'm not sure either could have happened. Meaning, had I just had that kind of emotional connection with Liza alone, without the Liza on the list, us calling Liza and then suddenly finding the footage, wouldn't have happened. And vice versa, had I just, reached out to Liza and we talked to them, but I hadn't had that kind of emotional connection, because me and Broadway have a kind of long, rich history. I produced a film called Best Worst Thing That Ever Could Have Happened, which was about Sondheim and Hal Prince's Merrily We Roll Along and the creation of it, and how it didn't do well at the beginning but came a cult classic. So I'm always kind of totally engaged by Broadway stories and big, over-the-top, juicy Broadway stories. And in many ways, there's no one bigger or more over-the-top or juicier than Liza's story.
Okay. So, quote, shut the fuck up, unquote. That's said by Liza Minnelli during your interview with her. The very
early in the film, it's almost the first thing she says.
The very opening of this documentary, essentially, it's a sort of behind the scenes setup. The very opening. Talk to me about why you chose to open the film the way that you did.
That's an interesting question because, you know, when you make these things, I try to do the opening last because I always feel if you cut the opening at the beginning and then you end up moving on and doing the other film, it often doesn't match because the film that you make later on in the process is very different from the one that you started with the tease. So we had a lot of different versions, and there was a point that I looked at it and I said, who am I kidding? It's like, this is Liza fucking Minnelli. She has to open the film. I want to fade up on her and give a flavor instantly of her personality. And I have to tell you, that opening sequence is really the first time I interviewed her. And I think that kind of captures her personality in a way that sometimes you don't expect. She really is. She's that witty, she's that funny, she's that kooky, she's that off the cuff. And I think hopefully as you get into the film, you see some of the seeds that were planted kind of in her performance by some of her mentors like Kay Thompson and these people who literally, certainly Kay, more than anybody, gave her that kind of kooky perspective of life. And once you understand that, it makes sense that she would start the film, okay, Liza, we're rolling, shut the fuck up. That's essential, Liza.
Were you nervous during that first interview? How did you approach it?
That's a very interesting question. First of all, it's not a nerves. What it is, I've been doing this a long time, so not really nerves. What it is you feel a overriding sense of gratefulness that you've been given this opportunity. Mm. I mean, how many millions
And you don't want to blow it.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't want to piss that person off.
How many millions of people, the pissing off doesn't bother me as much because I've done films and I've pissed off the subjects and that could be interesting also. But in Liza's case, you know, I did feel the weight of all the people in the audience at the palace who felt this enormous connection to this woman to make sure that I told her story and that it was authentic. And of course, you know, Liza is the greatest help along that because she, you know, and I tell the story, which is still amazes me that this happened to me, which is after a day of filming, Liza asked for me to come back, you know, have Bruce come back. And I went back in and she was in her bedroom sitting on the edge of the bed. And I came in, I'm like, Liza, you know, you called for me. And she reached up and she grabbed my hand and she started petting it. And she looked up at me with those kind of dark saucer eyes and said, please, Bruce, don't put in anything phony in the movie. Do not make me look like a phony. And that was one of the most incredible moments and incredible insights into Liza and her comfort with herself. Obviously, there have been times where she's glossed over things and kind of created the world as this old MGM musical of brightness and beauty and everything like that. But she wanted this to be real. And that was probably the thing that more than anything gave me kind of the backbone to be able to say, okay, we got to be truthful. Not that I wouldn't have been anyway, but that it was doubled down and I felt more easily able to ask her about some things. Because at the beginning, when you sit across from somebody, let alone an icon, you're always dancing around. You're always trying to see how far can I go? Will they talk about this? Will they talk about that? And with Liza, nothing was really, you know, off the table, which was great.
I was just going to ask you, were there any things, any topics, any subjects off limit or maybe that you wanted specifically to talk about?
No, I mean, I think she was really happy. I think one of the things that really relaxed her was that we were very interested in her mentors. I'm not sure a ton of interviewers over the years has wanted to have a really long conversation with her about Charles Asdaborn and what he did for her and why she thought he was so talented. So I think when I started tapping into things that she was interested in, I think that's when things started gelling very nicely. I think that and, you know, I always say, if you want Liza to be your friend for life, you crack a joke and have her laugh. Because if she laughs once, she's your friend for life. She loves telling jokes. She loves having people around her who are funny. And I learned that pretty early on that, you know, keep the jokes coming.
The title, Liza, A Truly Terrific, Absolutely True Story. That's the full title. Is there a story behind choosing this specific title?
Well, it goes without question. We probably had a list of about over 100 titles. And there was a moment when I said, okay, when you have, so rarely I may add, a subject with a one name instant memory, Liza, everybody knows who you're talking about, that has to be the big title. So once that was kind of taken care of, it was like, okay, what could be the subtitle? And that was where we had 100 different variations. And I think ultimately I decided that it made the most sense to have a subtitle phrase that Liza herself actually said, words she actually said. So then it was a question of watching the movie, watching interviews, finding something that could be like a fun title. And when it connected with, you know, her intro written by Fred Ebb to Ring Them Bells, in the Liza with a Z concert when she says, you know, I have a truly terrific, absolutely true story. And when I told this, you know, story to, you know, my friends are songwriters and they turned it. So I think it was essential Liza for a couple of reasons. One, it is so Liza, just the terminology, you know, truly terrific, you know, absolutely, you know, that's very, very, very Liza. And I think the fact that she actually said it in an iconic moment in her early life was, made sense. And I don't know why, but I seem to be partial. I'm sorry to everybody with long titles. You know, our Sondheim film was best worst thing that ever could have happened. I don't know. Sometimes you just play with words and it worked out. But it feels like, and once we kind of did the poster and you saw the layout of how the title plays out, it's like, okay, this title is going to work. So we're very happy with it.
After this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, I'm Agnes. My new record, Magic Still Exists, is out now. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
This is gay hip-hop artist, the Mangfather Bob Katz. An artist friend of mine recommended that I check out Mark Tara's Rainbow Country years ago, and I've been enjoying it ever since. Mark's excellent interviews highlight all aspects of the LGBTQ community, and he's not afraid to ask the difficult questions that other hosts avoid. And I love, love, love the music that Mark plays on Rainbow Country each week, especially when he plays my music. But seriously, Mark Tara has been such a supporter of my music and has turned me on to so many great LGBTQ artists that I'd never heard of before. I'm so grateful to Mark Tara's Rainbow Country.
Bill 7. To ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing based on a person's sexual orientation was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill, but without some progressive conservative legislators' backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
I'm Billy Newton Davis, and we're sitting here on Rainbow Country with the fabulous Mark Tara.
So, Bruce David Klein, you are an Emmy-nominated producer. In, I believe it was 1989, you started Atlas Media Corporation, your multi-award-winning production company. So here's my question for you. How did this all start for you? Did you start off as an actor, as a singer, as a dancer, as an instrumentalist? How did you get into the world of entertainment originally?
I was always a writer. I mean, first of all, I'll take that back. As a kid, I always made home movies, mostly horror movies, mostly of me killing my friends with blood splattering all over the place. So that was fun. But I was primarily for many years a writer, and I certainly got into entertainment and Broadway through studying writing, literature, and also lyric writing. Big fan of Stephen Sondheim, Frank Lesser, Fred Ebb. You know, just the genius of taking a soup and making a bouillon cube out of these lyrics where you have such a short period of time to kind of tell stories and evoke emotion. So that always fascinated me. So basically, I started Atlas Media as a vehicle for me to be able to write and produce, you know, kind of whatever excited me at that moment. Of course, you know, as the company grew, I got further and further away from actually physically writing myself because we hired writers, we hired producers to do things. But about 5 or 6 years ago, I started going much more back to my roots and started spending a lot more time doing kind of more personal projects that were important to me. So as I said, I produced Best Worst Thing That Ever Could Have Happened. And I just did a film for HBO on the corporate Raider billionaire Carl Icahn and now Liza Minnelli. So these are things that just kind of really interest me. But my core interest has always been writing and storytelling. So that's kind of where it came from.
Hmm. You've done a lot of work in television, in film. Do you have a preference as to which medium you work in?
I think it's funny because it's two sides of my personality. TV is fast, energetic, get it out there. You know, get it, you know, it's a little ephemeral sometimes, but get it out there. Film is slow and careful and thoughtful. And, you know, the Liza film really from soup to nuts took 2.5 years to do. Whereas, you know, we have done 13-part series for cable networks that, you know, are done in 4 months. So those, in effect, I think there's a reason I do both, because those are the two sides of my personality. I have a kind of hyper side, wanting to do things fast, but then I have, I like to think of a more thoughtful side, where I like to kind of go in deep on things that interest me.
You've produced films that have been on network television, channels like TLC, the History Channel, you just mentioned HBO, the Food Network. For yourself, when you're creating content, for you, what makes good content?
Honestly, it sounds like a cliche, but it's true. It is a great story and a great character, and that's it. It's a great story and a great character. Obviously, there generally with a great character is conflict of some sort, you know. In the case of Liza, certainly as part of our story, the conflict was, how was she ever going to get from out of her mother's shadow, her mother and father's shadow? How was she ever going to make a name? And it's not even making a name for herself. It's how was she going to express herself as an artist in a way that was unique and different from her mother and her father? I find that story fascinating. I find it fascinating because, first of all, how many children of superstars, and Judy Garland was a superstar, and certainly for many years, the superstar, plus her father, you know, obviously Vincent Minnelli, you know, is a genius. The MGM look that we know of, the MGM musical look, is so reliant on his vision. And to think of those two, and Liza having to overcome all of the expectations. We went back and watched a lot of footage of interviews with her, with journalists from the 70s. And every question was, will you ever be as good a singer as your mother? Will you ever be as good a dancer as your mother? Do you really have movie star looks? Would your father have ever hired you? I mean, it's just incredible. And, you know, we have a scene in the film where, you know, a French male, I may add, journalist asked her, you know, what do you say to people who say you're ugly? You know, which is like, you know, it's almost comedy. I mean, people in the theater when they watch it are like aghast. I laugh out loud because to me, you're looking at Liza. She's like 25, 24. She's gorgeous. And her eyes are like, you know, glittering with just excitement and this kind of fizzy, bubbly energy. And this guy's asking, you know, how does it feel like to be ugly? It's just unbelievable. These expectations on Liza Minnelli from such an early age made the fact that she was privileged, which she was born on third base. She had absolutely, you know, Hollywood royalty as her family parents. And yet she was able to get from third base to home in a way that in some ways was harder than for many other people rounding all the bases, because they don't have those expectations, terrible expectations, the black cloud following her. And I think, you know, I just say, how many children of mega celebrities, stars, talented stars like Judy and Vincent, how many of their children in Hollywood have a, you know, halfway, amazing career as Liza? How many have attained the status of their parents, let alone in some eyes exceeded it in some ways? How many can you count? Not many. And I think that's that kind of conflict of great personality, Liza, great story, how Liza became Liza. And obviously it helps that, you know, she's a damn good singer. So, you know, worst case scenario, you get into, you know, a corner, you just let her sing and, you know, brings down the house every time.
In researching her life, especially with the 25 hours of newly found footage that you had access to, did you come across anything that even surprised you when you were researching Liza Minnelli?
Well, the two things that surprised me about Liza as we made this film was A, this idea of privilege for her being a double-edged sword. And because of the expectations, how hard it was for her to kind of make a name for herself. That was a kind of eye-opener as we delved into it. And the other thing that was very kind of inspirational in a way was the lesson that you could almost take out of Liza's life about the power of mentors to kind of transform us. And I think a lot of us keep people who can help us, mentors, you know, at kind of an arm's length, and they don't let them in. And as a result, you know, they may not go as far or may not develop their talent as much as it could be if they kind of let these, you know, mentors into their lives. So I think one of the surprising things is seeing how important mentors, her mentors were to her, how much they helped transform her and focus her enormous talent, and also kind of a lesson to all of us that, you know, open yourself up to mentors and you're probably going to be a better, more talented, more successful person.
I just have a handful of minutes left with you. Here's my last question for you. And you make an incredibly entertaining and insightful documentary telling Liza Minnelli's story. Star-studded. You've got George Hamilton. You've got Mia Farrow. Ben Vereen. The late, great Cheetah Rivera, just to name four legends. My last question for you, what do you hope audiences come away with after they've experienced Liza?
That's a good question. I think that for me, I'm always looking at pleasing two audiences and having them both take away something. I think for core Judy and Liza fans, I want them to take away a profound understanding of how Liza became Liza, how important her mother was to that equation, but how important it was for Liza to spread her wings and kind of go forth. And quite frankly, the other side of the equation, people who may not know that much about Liza, I want them to take away, my God, I thought she was a sitcom star, and she is one fucking mega talented woman. And it sounds crazy, but I mean, as we produced the film, we would often talk to people of different ages and we'd say like, do you know who Liza's mother is? And we were shocked. I'm saying 50, maybe 40% of the people who are, let's say, under 35 did not know Judy Garland was Liza's mother. So I think that being able to explain who Liza was and show how remarkable she was and tell this story of mentorship and the importance of it, I think if people get half of that when they watch the film, I will be very, very happy. And hopefully, as a lot of the reviewers have said, which is maybe the highest compliment, is as soon as I finished the movie, I watched Cabaret. You know, that in some way is one of the great, you know, greatest reviews you can get.
You know, just on an aside, from the UK, there was in 2023, there was a 5-CD box set of like 80s gay dance floor hits that was released. One of those tracks was "Don't Drop Bombs," Liza Minnelli and Pet Shop Boys.
I thought you were going to do "Losing My Mind," Pet Shop Boys.
No, they chose that particular song.
Interesting.
Yes, yeah. It's great.
Yeah,
it's great.
Well, I'm going to have to, defend the film against people who were saying, why didn't you put in the Pet Shop Boys and Liza? But unfortunately, that, as well as many other storylines, just couldn't fit in once we kind of honed this film
Absolutely.
To tell the story of her mentors.
Absolutely. I have to say, Bruce David Klein, well said, well done, well made, an absolutely excellent, excellent film. Well done. Thanks for being
Thank
on the show.
You. Go see the movie. We want fannies and seats to experience Liza, and nothing like it seeing her on the big screen. She's just incredible.
Gather around, I got a story to tell.
Tony's, a Grammy, an Emmy, even an Oscar, she has done it all.
She has achieved that rare status where only a first name is necessary.
One and only Liza.
I gotcha! Uh-huh, you thought I didn't see you now, didn't you?
Born to Hollywood royalty.
Vincente Minnelli.
Superstar Judy Garland.
I thought, Mama, she's never going to pass.
Her fight was to find who she was. She didn't want to be her mother.
Her mother's passing was a catalyst.
A period of incubation.
She found friends and mentors who helped her.
He gave her an entire sense of self.
There was so much expected of her.
She had the thing that you can't teach.
She blossomed.
Everybody wanted to be with Liza. Everybody wanted her at their parties.
She's hot, she's sexy, she's weird, and she had that fierceness and so much vulnerability.
How are you doing?
Terrific.
Hmm?
Fine.
I feel wonderful about love.
Excuse me.
Because I wanted it to be like it was in the songs.
That last husband of hers, I was at the wedding. Oh, my God.
Legendary actress and singer Liza Minnelli has checked into rehab.
I was very worried.
How lucky I was to have gone through all of the bad stuff that I've gone through, because it prepared me for the rest of my life.
If the public sees Liza as a barrel of sequins and glamour, they've got her wrong.
She wanted to consume the fullness of life. I don't think she has any regrets.
By the way, on Thursday, March 5th, 2026, Liza Minnelli was honored with the first ever Storyteller Award at the 37th Annual GLAAD Media Awards. Her memoir, Kids, Wait Till You Hear This, is out now. You can watch the documentary, Liza, A Truly Terrific, Absolutely True Story, on Amazon Prime Video, Apple TV, and YouTube.
Magnus Hirschfeld made the modern homosexual. He co-founded the world's first gay rights group, the Scientific Humanitarian Committee, in Berlin in 1897. But what is far more important is that he and his colleagues came up with an enormously influential concept of what same-sex desire was, what it meant, and how it fit into the wider world. If you think homosexuality is an inborn quality that cannot be changed and has a biological root, but is not an illness, and if you think gay people are a sexual minority who are born that way, and who deserve legal protections just as racial minorities do, you owe those ideas to Hirschfeld and a handful of others. He was among the first to articulate that conceptual model of what it means to be gay in print in 1896.
We just heard professor, author, and historian of queer and trans politics, Lori Marhoefer, reading from Racism and the Making of Gay Rights, a sexologist, his student, and the Empire of Queer Love, their powerful new gay history book, about the man who made the modern homosexual, a German physician and sexologist who died at the age of 67 in 1935, Magnus Hirschfeld.
Hi, I'm Justin Ling, author of Missing from the Village.
You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Don't draw bones.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, a song written and produced by the Pet Shop Boys. The track, Don't Drop Bombs, performed by Liza Minnelli.
Don't drop bombs.
Hi, this is Police Constable Danielle Botno, also known as LGBT Cop, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
This is hour two of Rainbow Country, where I feature music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. So if you stay with me, if you stick with me, I hope you think I'm bringing you music worth hearing. Starting us off, a Canadian disco set.